Welcome, Mark Reynolds.
Morning. Welcome to day two of our 2019 conference. I first of all want to say to the people in Louisiana who got stuck in the Atlanta airport for a long time, we're sorry you got stuck there, but we are so happy you're here. Thank you for hanging in there, and thanks for making it. Five years ago, I read a study about what are the five most stressful jobs in America. Number one and two are Afghanistan and Iraq. Three and four are police and firework, and number five is event planning. So if you've done event planning, you understand that entirely. So, you know, in Jean-Paul Sartre's play, Last Exit, he said, hell is other people. If you're an event planner, hell is your own mind. Because you're constantly dealing with, you know, all the things that could go wrong, that you're convinced will go wrong, that many times over history have. And it's this just unbelievably stressful job that our conference staff does just an exceptional job of not only doing, but doing with grace in class the whole time. So I'd like them to come up so that we could thank them for putting on another amazing conference. They are such a joy to work with. It's just amazing on a day-by-day basis, given the job they do. In the 1980s, a book came out called Watership Down. The main characters in that book were rabbits. And for those of you who read it, you know it was a really, really good book. The rabbits had a really interesting counting system, in that their counting system went one, two, three, many. 6 years ago, Bob Inglis was our keynote speaker at the conference, a former Republican from South Carolina. And, you know, he knew we were a bipartisan organization and we were committed to being nonpartisan and really committed to growing the number of conservatives in our organization. So he asked the people who were conservative to please stand up, and many people stood up. Barely. So I asked Jim Tolbert, who is our Director of Conservative Outreach, to introduce Catherine Hayhoe. He and the Conservative Caucus have done really an amazing job of growing the number of people who identify themselves as right of center of being part of this organization, which is really important. Jim Tolbert, please join me.
Thanks. It is a great honor to be able to introduce our keynote speaker today, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, who often reaches out to right of center audiences. I have the privilege of working with conservative caucus members in CCL that are, many of them sitting around you with a red banner badge. And those are the people that go out and speak to college Republicans, young Republicans, National Federation for Republican Women's Clubs across the country. They're also the people that have tabled at the GOP state conventions in Texas, California, and Utah. And they're the people that frequently, they're the people that frequently reach out to the conservatives that are right across the fences we build in our own backyards. Something we ask all of us to try and do. My honor in introducing Dr. Catherine Hayhoe is much deeper than that, though. My honor is more because of her scientific background and credentials and approach. I was raised in a family that valued independence, staunch independence, some might say. Some might say stubbornness. But I was also raised in a family that valued science. My Aunt Marion researched lipoprotein metabolism at the University of Washington. My Uncle Bert developed and grew the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at UC Boulder, and where his daughter is currently a professor of atmospheric chemistry. And my dad My dad was a professor of biochemistry at Michigan State University and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. All right, some Michigan State fans. He instilled in me a driven approach to question deeper the scientific material that I struggled with and dealt with. He also encouraged in me an approach to see connections between scientific disciplines. And Dr. Hayhoe epitomizes both of these approaches. So it is a great honor to introduce a scientist, a respected scientist with over 100 peer-reviewed technical papers, with a bachelor's in astronomy and physics and a master's and a PhD in atmospheric science. She was the lead author on the second, the third, and the fourth national climate assessments. To make this work she's doing, To make this work she's doing more accessible, she took many extra steps. She created and hosts the PBS Studios podcast, Global Weirding, now in its third season. She has a TED Talk that's on YouTube that has over 1.5 million views on climate science, and has a transcript available in 16 languages. As a reflection of her communication skills, the 10-year-old out-of-print science book that she wrote with her husband, A Climate for Change, is now available on Amazon as a worn copy for 3 times its original list price. Yeah. So please give a warm introduction to a respected scientist, a great communicator, and a friend of Citizens Climate Lobby, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe.
Thank you so much. Are we done now? Actually, we're not. And I know this is a huge room, and it feels like there's a lot of people, but in many ways, we also kind of feel like family, too. So rather than giving you, you know, a talk where I talk to you a lot about the science, well, there has to be some science, because that's what I do, I want to have a conversation. And the way that we're going to be able to do this conversation with so many of us together is you're going to take out your smartphone, if you have one, your iPhone or phone. If you have a laptop, you could use a laptop too. And you're going to go to pollev.com/Texas Tech. That is my university. If you're on the phone, it'll ask you to enter your name, but you don't have to. There's no data being collected here. Anonymous is totally fine. Go to pollev.com, so pollev.com/Texas Tech, and you don't have to enter your name. Okay, so once you've gone there, here is your first test. Your first test is that it will ask you where do you live? And there will be a map that you can click on and tell us where you live. It's trying really hard. It's trying very hard, in fact, you can see. You can do this, come on. There we go, look at that. All right, so every green dot is where you live. It looks like we've got a couple of people from Canada. We've got a few people out in the middle of the ocean. Welcome. Yep. I'm glad that you were able to swim in from your sailboat, which is currently halfway across the Atlantic. And now I'm going to ask you the second question. How many CCL conferences have you attended? Is it your first one? If so, answer A. Your second? At least 3. Too many to remember, and all of them. This is amazing. So almost 60% of us, it's our first one. Yeah. That is really cool. If I had to answer, my answer would be B, But it's been a number of years. In fact, it has been 4 years since I was here. And last time I was here, it was really awesome because I was here with the 700 Club. They were here to kind of track what I was doing for the day and then have a conversation with me and my husband, who's a pastor, about a changing climate and about how if you're a Christian, you actually already have all the values you need to care about this planet and the people who inhabit it. So you can still find my husband and I talking climate change on the 700 Club, and there's some clips from this meeting 4 years ago there. But what I want to do is I want to introduce myself to you because I am one of your science advisors. You may have heard my name, you may not have. So because we're family, rather than giving you, you know, some big talk, I just want to tell you who I am and what I do. So the first and kind of most obvious thing I do is I am an atmospheric scientist. In other words, I study this thin blue line that you see around the Earth. Just how thin is our atmosphere? Well, it's often, there we go. An apple is often used as an analogy that the apple itself would be the Earth and the skin of the apple would be the atmosphere. That's how thin the atmosphere is. But when you do the calculations, it turns out that the skin of an apple is actually 20 times thicker than the atmosphere. So I study something that is incredibly thin, incredibly fragile, more like the outside layer of an onion, yet that thing that we study, that atmosphere, is essential for life on this planet. In fact, if we did not have an atmosphere, that is the only difference between a frozen ball of ice versus the Earth that we inhabit today. That minuscule skin of the onion is the difference between a lifeless frozen planet versus the planet that teems with life in the oceans, land, the atmosphere, and more. We've known this for a really long time. Speaking of other scientists for a moment, because I love looking back in history, we've known that our planet's atmosphere had trace amounts, tiny amounts of heat-trapping gases in it that keeps it over 60 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it should be since the work of Joseph Fourier in the 1820s. That's 200 years we've known about this. We've known which gases there were, and I promise you this is the only chemistry that we're going to get into. Water vapor. I know, I hear the calls for more chemistry. Water vapor, methane, CO2. John Tyndall, a British scientist in the 1850s, actually identified which gases were responsible for the fact that our planet is warmer than it should be. And he even went further. Do you know that he linked methane specifically to coal mining? And he figured out in the 1850s that by digging up and burning coal, we were actually increasing the levels of these gases in the atmosphere. Now, at the same time, on the other side of the Atlantic, there was John Tyndall's exact opposite. John Tyndall was a very educated scientist. He had degrees, he had done postdocs and research positions all around Europe. On the other side of the Atlantic, there was a woman called Eunice Foote. Now, we're not 100% sure that this really is Eunice. Her seventh great niece and I are tracking down photos. We found her daughters, we found her husband. People think this might be her, but we haven't confirmed it yet. But I like to show a picture. This is what she would look like if it were her. She was the opposite. She was not trained in the sciences. She did not have the advantages of all the latest advances in European understanding. She was an amateur scientist and an advocate for women's rights. And in her spare time, she did experiments, including putting a bunch of glass jars out in the backyard in the sun with different types of gases in them and measuring how their temperature changed. She wrote up her work, and it was presented on her behalf at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 1856, a meeting that still exists today, which I presented at last year. And in it, she said, now, they used a lot of words back then, so let me just translate this. She's talking about carbon dioxide, and she says, if there were more of it than at present, an increased temperature would result. Isn't that amazing? A woman with nothing more than her very intelligent brain in her backyard and some glass jars in upstate New York in 1856, speculating that if CO2 were higher, the planet would be warmer. You might say, okay, but we've advanced a lot. Now we actually know how much warmer, depending on if we continue to depend on fossil fuels or if we reduce our emissions through transitioning to clean energy, we know how much warmer it would be. Well, we've known how much warmer the planet would be, depending on whether we double or triple levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, since the work of Arrhenius in the 1890s. He was a physical chemist who won the Nobel Prize for his work in physical chemistry. But on the weekends, he decided he was going to calculate by hand how much the planet would warm if we continued to depend on fossil fuels. And his numbers were very close to what we get today. He even calculated how much warmer the Arctic would be than the rest of the planet. Yeah. So we've known for more than 100 years that we have these trace gases in the atmosphere that are the thermostat of our planet. And by digging up and burning coal and gas and oil, we're wrapping an extra blanket around our planet that it does not need. This is the reason the planet is warming and our future truly is in our hands. So let me ask you this. How many of these scientists I talked about had you already heard of? Now be honest, because nobody knows what your answer is, okay? Total surprise. Heard a few names, everyone except Eunice, and some smarty pants know them all. Oh, I love this. Okay, we're at 40% total surprise, 30% I've heard a few names, 20% everyone except Eunice, and then about 10% know them all. Excellent. Well, there's a reason why there's 10% there. And one of the reasons why is because we have this PBS series called Global Weirding, and one of our episodes is called How Long Have We Known About This? And it goes through every single one of these names, including Eunice. So 90% of you, you need to go out and watch that episode and share it. And that's the second thing I want to tell you about myself. So in addition to being a scientist and a professor, I teach classes, I do research, I write research grants, I also host this PBS YouTube series, and the reason I'm able to do that is because the financial support that we have for it, which pays for the cartoon and the art design, I donate my time, PBS donates their time, the financial support comes from you. And your support is amazing, because that is what helps us not only create these, but spread them. So right now, we have over 13,000 subscribers. Our videos between Facebook and YouTube have gotten hundreds of thousands of views. We just finished this season. The season runs from about September to March. We just finished this season with a look at every single region around the United States. So whatever region you're from, we have an episode specifically for you, and of course we had to do one for Canada too. So let me ask you, when it comes to global weirding, again, you can be honest, nobody's tracking your name. I'm hearing about it for the first time. I've watched an episode or two. I've watched them all. And I make everybody I know watch them. All right, this is good, because what I need you to do is go to YouTube. You don't have to do it right now, but think about it when you're at your computer. Go to YouTube or on your phone right now and go ahead and subscribe. Go ahead and subscribe to our YouTube series. And the reason why I want you to know about this is because this is a resource for you. Often, when I travel around the country and I meet with people at different CCL chapters around the country, people say, well, we've got all these great new volunteers, but they don't feel like they know enough to really have a good conversation about this. How do we really know? Like, what if somebody says it's just a natural cycle? What do I say? Or what if somebody says, well, it doesn't matter to us, warmer's better if we live in Alaska. What do I say? Or they say, oh, you know, those scientists are just making it up for the money. How do I know that isn't true? That is actually the title of our third most popular episode. Our second most popular episode is, if I just tell them the facts, surely they'll change their minds, right? Answer is no. But, and then this completely surprised me. I had no idea this was going to happen. Our most popular episode, the one everybody wants to watch, is what does the Bible say about climate change? And the answer to that is nothing, but also, in a way, everything. So these are resources for you to use. Use them with your family. They're not all cartoons, most of it is me talking, but they are appropriate for kids. Use it with people who are coming into your CCL group who feel like they want to learn a little bit more. You don't have to watch them in any particular order, just pick and choose the questions that you have, but this is a resource for you so that you feel equipped, you feel empowered, you are able to respond to the questions you get because you know what the truth is. I should also add that they're really short. They're all about 5 to 7 minutes, so you can easily share them and watch them and put them on social media, watch them on your phone. You don't have to sit there for a 3-hour documentary. Now, I want to tell you a story about why we even have the Global Weirding episodes. And this is the first person who's still alive, so I made sure to tell you that. All the other pictures are people who are dead. In fact, Brian, I think, is here today. Yes, Brian? Yes. Yep. Right there, right there. And he has the same hat on. So why do we have the Global Weirding series? It isn't only because of your financial support, it's actually because the idea came from a CCL member. Brian works at Houghton College, which is a small Christian college in upstate New York that is, as far as I can tell, about an hour from everywhere. Is that correct? Including the grocery store. And he contacted me a few years ago and said, would you be able to come speak at Houghton? So, as you know, I do as much as I can, but I said, you know, I don't really have any other speaking engagements in the area. I do visit my family in Toronto. Maybe if we worked out the time, I could drive down. And he's like, well, the reason I want you to come is because I want to do an experiment. And as a scientist, I'm like, oh, okay. He said, I know you do all these talks, and I want to actually run an experiment as part of my master's thesis to see if attending a talk that you give makes a difference to people's opinions. I said, yes, that would be fantastic. Because if not, I will quit. It's a lot of pressure. But seriously, you want to do what's most valuable with your time, and if going and talking to students at a Christian college was not making any dent, why bother, right? But then we had another idea. What if when the students showed up for the talk, they were directed into one of two rooms? One room had me on video giving a talk, and the other room had me live giving the same talk. Yes. So Brian got together, actually, with my dad, who's a science educator who works at a Christian university in Canada called Tyndale, and they found, first of all, excellent news, that there was a significant difference before and after attending about 35, 40-minute talk that I gave. So that's why I'm still doing this 5 years later. But what really connects to Global Weirding is that he found there was no significant difference between the live versus the recorded lecture. So you might say, wow, I really wish you could come visit my chapter. And I put my stuff online so that you know, whenever I'm in the area, I do want to visit you. But it turns out it doesn't matter. You already have recorded me, and apparently recorded me is just as good, which is awesome, Because instead of speaking to 80 or 100 or even 200 people in a room where I fly somewhere and I burn a lot of carbon and I spend 3 days, you can get 10,000 people watching a video. Or 35,000 if it's about what the Bible says about climate change. So that's the story of global weirding and what it has to do with CCL. Yes. What else do I want to tell you about myself? Well, the third thing I want to tell you is that I live in Texas. Yeah. All right. I work at Texas Tech at the Climate Science Center, and people often say to me, first of all, oh, that's in Austin, isn't it? It is in Lubbock. And then people often say to me, why do you live there? And the reason I am in Texas, I did not know this when it first happened, but I have realized, it has been borne on upon me with a sledgehammer at some times, that there are three very important reasons why I am in Texas and why I deliberately continue to be in Texas. Reason number one is I live in one of the states where there's a lot of people who think what I do is two steps lower down the credibility ladder from astrology. There's nothing that makes you pull up your socks faster than having pretty much every single person you know question your credibility in the grocery store, at the realtors, and at your university. This is a map from the Yale Program on Climate Communication. I love their maps. They have a whole series of maps, including Do You Support a Price on Carbon, which is actually uniformly orange across the whole country. Yeah. They have results by county and by congressional district, so I would encourage you to go here and spend some time looking at your congressional district's opinions from this resource, because it will give you a lot of great information. When you go see a congressman or woman, you're like, well, did you know that 82% of people in your district support taxing fossil fuels? And they'll be like, no, I didn't know that. So this is a great tool. But I live in one of the places where there's the most resistance to accepting the science of climate change. And as I talk about in my TED Talk, this is the TED Talk I did a couple months ago, I'm only going to tell you the first story from it, nothing else. So if you haven't watched it, you'll have to go watch it to get the rest. But as I talk about in my TED Talk, the very first class I taught at Texas Tech University when I was a brand new professor, just arrived as a research professor, a colleague asked me to guest teach his undergraduate geology class while he was out of town at a conference. So I prepared a full presentation on the geologic history of carbon throughout the life of the Earth. I waded through deep time, I talked about geologic weathering, I talked about orbital cycles. And when I got to the end, as most professors do, I looked hopefully around for any questions. Most students were kind of slumped over their phones, dozing. It was early in the morning, in their defense. But one hand right in the middle shot straight up. So I looked encouraging, and he stood up, and in a loud and rather belligerent tone, he said, "You're a Democrat, aren't you?" In Lubbock, Texas, the second most conservative city in the U.S. after Provo, Utah, and I have spoken at Brigham Young, too. In Lubbock, Texas, we have Republican candidates for each election, and then we have conservative Republican candidates that spend all their time talking about how liberal and socialist the Republicans are. So this is the first reason why I'm in the best place you could be, right? Scientist who specifically studies what climate change means to us in the places where we live. And today, one of the biggest ways climate change is affecting us personally is through exacerbating or supersizing what used to be naturally occurring disasters. And Texas is already in the crosshairs. Texas gets almost every type of weather and climate disaster you can imagine. The only one they don't get is the floods from when mountain snow melts too quickly and runs down the hill because we don't have the mountains. But we get everything else. We get ice storms and blizzards. We get drought and flood. We get hail, thunderstorms, tornadoes, haboobs and dust storms, hurricanes. We get pretty much everything. Since 1980, there have been 105 weather and climate events that have caused at least $1 billion worth of damage in Texas alone. And again, the number one reason we care about a changing climate today is because it's exacerbating these risks. So I just happen to live also in the state that is most vulnerable to the impacts of a changing climate. And then I also live in the state that has the most wind energy of any state in the country. And I live in a part of the state where if we just took about 100 by 100 square mile area, 100 this way, 100 that way, which if you know West Texas is what, 3 farms? Maybe a bit more. And covered it with present-day technology solar panels, that would be enough to supply the entire country. Yes. So when it comes to climate change, I want to ask you this question. What is unique about your state or region? What is unique about your region? If you're from Texas, try to think of something else too. You can enter a whole sentence, you can enter multiple words, you can enter a single word. Totally up to you. No, I do not accept the nothing, people. Do not accept it. I went to graduate school in Illinois, and even in Illinois, there's something special. My cousin said, do not watch Children of the Corn before you move to Illinois. All right, so what have we got here? We've got algae bloom, hawks, lots of solar, extreme fires, sea level rise, flooding. You've got Washington in your region. That's special. So there's impacts that we're seeing, there's solutions we're seeing, and there's also opportunities to have conversations that we're seeing that are unique. Yes, floods. I'm guessing that's the Midwest. There's opportunities to have conversations about these things. Every region is unique, and where you are from is a really important part of the conversation that you can have with people. But I am Canadian, too. And why is that important? Well, first of all, it's important because there is a very important game tonight. Now, Golden State might win this one. I mean, for their self-respect, they should. I can say this because my husband is a huge fan of the Warriors. He got to meet Steph Curry's dad the other day, and he was so thrilled. But we're going to take it. Nicely. In all seriousness, though, why is it also important for me to be Canadian? It is because in the United States, for the last 5 years, so during the Obama administration until now, climate change has been one of the most politically polarized issues in the entire United States, where the number one predictor of whether you agree that climate is changing, humans are responsible, the impacts are serious, and we should act, is not how much you know about science, about impacts. It is simply where you fall on the political spectrum. That is it. And so, not falling on the political spectrum, being part of a multidimensional political spectrum, as we have in Canada, I can tell people a thermometer is not liberal or conservative. It's not Republican or Democrat. It doesn't give us a different answer depending on how we vote. We can agree, and we have to agree sometimes, to disagree about solutions. We have to, because we may have our favorite solution. I kind of think most people here do. Just a thought. We might have our favorite solution, but scientifically speaking, the planet doesn't care how we cut the carbon. It just cares that we do it. So when people say, well, I'm not in favor of the carbon tax in Canada, and there's a lot of people on social media who are really up in arms on that, my response as a scientist is this: fair enough. So what's your plan to cut carbon? Then, in addition to being a scientist and doing global weirding and living in Texas and being Canadian, I am also a lead author on the National Climate Assessment. And this is a really huge part of what I do. In fact, it's taken up the majority of my life for the last 3 years. The National Climate Assessment, the first volume, which talks about the science of climate change, was released a year ago last November. So not 2018, 2017. Volume one is 100% crystal clear that climate is changing, humans are responsible, the impacts are serious, and the window of time to avoid even more dangerous impacts is closing fast. Then we have volume two. Volume two brings it down to the places where we live. There's a chapter for every region. There's a chapter for almost every sector, from water to national security and international interests. And in volume two, which was released on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving this past year, in volume two, it tells us that climate change is no longer a distant issue. It's here and now. It's affecting every region and nearly every sector of the U.S. today. We are actually starting to adapt, even if we don't call it that, but we're not doing it fast enough. Our choices matter today more than ever. As one of the few non-federal authors of this massive report, I do a lot of myth-busting. This is a thread I started on Twitter that I've been adding to as recently as this past few weeks, where I document all of the false information and false statements that have been made about the National Climate Assessment. Just this weekend, a new report came out saying that there was going to be another review of the National Climate Assessment after its publication. Now, let's just be clear. The National Climate Assessment, before it could be released, was first of all reviewed by relevant experts from every major federal agency. Then it was opened for public review, and anyone, any scientist, any person from anywhere in the world, actually, not just the US, could comment on the public review. We authors had to respond to every single comment we received, and our responses, as well as the comments, are a matter of public record. Yes. Imagine how long that took. Then they sent it to the National Academy of Sciences, who convened a special panel of external experts to review the report, and the National Academy's review of Volume 1 alone was over 100 pages. Volume 1 was just under 500 pages, so 20% the length, and we had to respond to every single one of those points, of course, and our response was also public record, and then it went back to the federal agencies again. Yet somehow, in the most comprehensive review of any scientific report in the United States, somehow that appears to be insufficient. It now needs to undergo a red review. But a red review is not a scientific review, because it has already gone through a scientific review by anyone who cared to offer one. And so when they asked me my opinion, I said, true science is debated in the scientific literature, not in kangaroo courts that are set up by politicians with agendas that rely on muddying the waters and hiding the truth to succeed. So that's what I spend a lot of time doing. And a lot of this involves talking about climate change. And when we first start talking about climate change, and you have probably experienced this, because we all talk about climate change, when we first start talking about it, we think everyone will care about it for the same reasons I do. Now, be honest, have you thought that? Thank you. I didn't collect the statistics, but I think the majority of us would agree. So my first talk to that group of undergraduate geology students in that cavernous lecture hall, I assumed science is so cool, clearly they would think so too. Wrong. Then we think, okay, stage two. Everybody needs to care about it for the same reasons I do. So what do I need to do? I need to change people's values. Well, if you have children, you know that the values get hardwired in at an early age. There's not a lot of teenagers, let alone 20, 30, or 40-year-olds, and certainly not 60 or 70-year-olds, wandering around going, oh, I don't feel like I have enough values. Please help me, mold me, guide me. And I think the fraction of politicians who would feel that way is about zero. So when I, after that geology class, when I got invited to speak to the League of Women Voters of Texas and the American Association of University Women and our local senior citizens home, I was thinking, okay, I figured out by now that they might not think science is the coolest thing, but so I have to show them it is. And people actually got a bit excited because it really is interesting. But then I started to get all these questions at the end, and the questions I got at the end were, so what? Like, okay, I can see you're excited and I can understand why you're excited, but so what? Like, you're telling us climate is changing due to human activities, you're talking about like 1 or 2 or 3 degrees. I mean, don't you understand that it's actually, you know, 3 degrees warmer in here than it is outside this room? So that's when I learned lesson number 3. I tried something that was very uncomfortable for a scientist to do. Not just talking about how I was an atmospheric scientist, or I wrote the National Climate Assessment, or I lived in Texas, or I was Canadian. I realized if we really, really want to connect with people, we have to go in with the attitude that they already have the values they need to care. I might not know what those are, but then it's on me to have the conversation with them and listen to them and figure out what they are. I might already figure out what they are because I've done my background research, but they haven't connected the dots yet. But all of a sudden, their job is 1,000 times easier. It's not trying to instill new values into people because, again, good luck. It's simply respecting, esteeming, appreciating the values people already have, which in most cases they have formed thoughtfully over the course of their life for a reason, and taking those values and connecting the dots, showing them how not only are they the perfect person to care, but by acting on climate, it actually expresses their pre-existing identity. It expresses their identity in an even more genuine way than they are today. Because that's what we want to be. We want to be the best version of who we are. And as a human, acting on climate actually moves us in that direction. We just have to connect the dots. So my first chance to try this out came when Second Baptist Church invited me to speak. This is all the first, like, 6 months of moving to Texas. And I realized that the one thing I had left out of my list was the one thing that most connected with their values, the fact that I was a Christian. Because I was getting some questions, too, where I started to realize people thought I was, you know, the liberal atheist scientist, and that's just what they thought scientists were. Of course, it turns out my colleague Elaine Eklund at Rice University, she's a sociologist who studies scientists and faith, and she has discovered through surveying, I think, almost 2,000 scientists at top research universities around the country, that 70% of us would describe ourselves as spiritual people. 70%. And of the remaining 30% who say that they're atheists, 20% of them describe themselves as spiritual atheists. So, you know, being a scientist, she dug into that a little more. It's very interesting. Her name is Elaine Eklund. If you want more on that, I gave a talk at the Upper House in Madison, Wisconsin in April where I get more into the whole question of science and faith. But I realized that if I was going to connect with people over their pre-existing values, what better value than one of the most central values to my own life? A value that tells me that we humans have been given responsibility for every living thing on this planet, which includes each other. We are called to tend the garden and be good stewards of the gifts that God has given us. And most relevant to a changing climate, we're told to love others and care for those people who are less fortunate than us, who are being most affected by a changing climate. Yes. So when I did that, and that first time, it felt really uncomfortable, but it was genuine. I mean, it is what I believe and who I am. When I did that, I saw the change in people's faces. They're like, oh, I'm that too. And I believe that too. And because I believe that, then that's why I would care. Of course. That's the response we want. Of course. So who we are is really important in the conversations that we have, and who the person is too. So then I was on a roll. Rotary Club, they print their values on a 4-foot sign. I got that. Farmers, they care about natural cycles and variability and higher temperatures and drought. I got that too. An oil and gas company. This was just 2 years ago. I had cruised through birders and churches and people interested in outdoor activities and parents worried about air quality for kids' health. But then I got an invitation to speak to an oil and gas company. And I firmly believe that we should not have a conversation unless we can find a point to agree on. If you cannot find something, some value that somebody has, that you genuinely and truly appreciate, you should not be having that conversation. There is someone else who will have it. It is not you. But I don't give up easily. So I thought to myself, what do I connect with? And this is what I realized. I realized that I am profoundly grateful for the benefits that energy brings us today. Just consider your life without refrigeration, having to go get food every day. What would our lives be like without electricity? What about transportation? I am grateful that I was able to fly here. I offset my emissions, yes, but I was grateful. And I'm incredibly grateful for the medical advances that came with the Industrial Revolution powered by fossil fuels. And then if you dig a bit deeper, what was life like before the Industrial Revolution? It was short, it was brutal, and it was very miserable for a lot of people. We depended primarily on animals for our labor, with a little bit of water. A woman's work was an endless cycle of drudgery. Laundry day was a full day, and that was back when people owned like 2 outfits each. I don't know how she's smiling there. I think it's more of a grimace. Even more seriously, issues like child labor and the fact that a large part of the United Kingdom and the US's economy was originally based on slave labor. So I realized that I am truly and profoundly grateful for the benefits and the blessings that fossil fuels have brought us. And when we talk about the future, it's not a case of pulling the plug on our energy, because we would be worse off if we did that today. It's a question of replacing the old ways of getting energy that we've been using for hundreds of years with newer and better sources of energy, just as we have replaced party line telephones with cell phones and horse-drawn carriages with cars. And who knows energy better than an energy company? So I went in to Pioneer, and we had a fantastic conversation. I expressed my gratitude for what they do. It is not an easy job. It is a very difficult job in many parts of the world. And they are the people who, despite the fact that in Texas we got 19.2% of our electricity from wind and solar last year, it is fossil fuels that really still keep the lights on. And so once we'd realized that, once they realized that I did understand what they did and why they did it, we had a two-hour conversation about how do we know climate is changing, how do we know it's not natural cycles or volcanoes, how is it affecting Texas. Turns out they're putting a wind farm on their operations. And then I invited their VP to come back to Texas Tech with me the next year to have a conversation with me and Bob Inglis about conservative solutions to a changing climate. So now I want to ask you, speaking personally, and either use one word, or if you have to use more than one word, put a dot in between your words, and you will see why in a second, okay? Speaking personally, why do you care about a changing climate? Why does it matter to you? I love this. All right, I'm not surprised. I guess that parent would be right up there. Parent, human, children, mother, grandfather, father, love it. But what else do we have too? We have, I'm an earthling, I'm a mountain lover, I'm a young person, and a millennial, just because I'm a woman, because I'm queer, because I'm a grandpa. Care about it because of animals or because I'm an animal? Not quite sure which that one is. Could be both. Because I'm a scout. Because I'm a hiker, because I'm a triathlete, because I'm a nature lover. So we already are who we are, and that's why we care. Now I want to ask you another question. And first of all, can I just say I love that human is right there. Human, that's why we care. And as far as I know, most of the people that you're going to talk to in your life are also human. Point of connection right there. So now I want to ask you this. Again, use a dot if you have more than one word. Who would you... from your mouth to God's ears, as they say. Who would you like to have a conversation with? Mitt Romney, the Koch brothers, Trump? My neighbor? Parents, students, my mom. Somebody said me in there, I think. You're having that right now. We're having a conversation right now. So friends, family, acquaintances, colleagues, leaders who are in favor like the Pope, leaders who are not in favor like Trump. All right. So of all of these people that you've identified, I want you to think to yourself this. I want you to think, how would I connect with that person's values? There we go. Think to yourself, how would I connect? And your answer is probably not going to be necessarily what you answered in terms of why you care, is it? How would you connect to that person's pre-existing values? Now, I want you to turn to one or two people beside you, behind you, or in front of you, and I want you to share. It's a friendly place. You'll be okay, I promise. You can just say pass. If you don't want to talk, you can just say pass. All right. I realize this could go for another half hour. And I want you to continue to think about this as you go through your day. But now, it's time. I want to end by emphasizing the word that showed up right in the middle of why we care about a changing climate. Because every single one of us on this planet, no matter who we are, no matter how we vote or don't, no matter what we believe or don't, no matter where we're from, what we look like, we all need air to breathe, clean air. We all need water to drink, clean water. We all of us want a safe place to live. We all of us need food. We were not designed to float around in outer space. We were designed to live on this perfect, amazing home that we have, and that is the single most important bond that we all share, no matter who we are on this planet. When I wrote a story for Foreign Policy 2 years ago, the story was about how we already care, about how just about every single one of us already cares, we just don't realize it, and they gave us the perfect picture. This is not the polar bear sitting on the ice. It's us. That is why we care. Thank you.
Catherine.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We do have time for one question, so we wanted to ask.
What we're actually going to do, we do have time for one question, and this is what we're going to do, and this is special for you. I'm going to ask the guy at the back to please go immediately to the very last slide in the entire deck, please. You can skim through all of them and just go to the last slide in the deck. And this is what I'm going to do. You're going to have to be fast with your fingers, though, okay? There we go. Put your question here. You can use as many words as you want. You don't have to join them with dots. And you can upvote the questions you prefer. So what we're going to do is put your questions in here. Put your questions in here, upvote the ones that you want answers to, and you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make a special video just for you guys that answers the top five questions. We'll put it on Facebook, we'll put it on our Global Weirding channel, and it will be your top five questions that I answer in this video. So it looks like you've got, let's see, you got one more minute to get your question in or to upvote the ones that you like. And you know what? My top question is your top question. What gives you hope? You have to be hopeful, because if we are not hopeful, we will be a self-fulfilling prophecy of despair. If there is no hope, why act? Why not eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow you die? I am hopeful, but I will tell you this. I am not hopeful because of what the science says. I am not hopeful because of what politicians are saying. I am hopeful because I see what people are doing. I am hopeful because I act myself. I am hopeful because I witness the actions of others. And I am hopeful because together we can affect change. together, we give each other hope. That is where it comes from. So stay hopeful, be informed by a knowledge of how bad it is. But the fact that our future is in our hands, our choices do make a difference. It is not too late to avoid the most serious and dangerous impacts. And every action counts. Thank you.
Please welcome Princella Talley.
Hello, everybody. So I am Princella Talley, and one of my jobs here is as a diversity coordinator. What I'm working on is building a strong and beautiful team that more accurately represents the diversity of the citizens we have in this beautiful country and world that we inhabit. Okay. And what I'm hoping to accomplish is a vast network that is a constant reminder showing us that everyone's voices and skill sets belong at the table to create a more livable world. Another part of my job is working as a development associate, which means that I get to work with Lene Pettingill. And one of the things I love most about Lene is her spirit of perseverance. She blends focus and kindness and grace. And Lene sees past what is and focuses on what can be. She reminds me to be brave. Brave enough to keep going when someone says no. Brave enough to embrace the vulnerable moments, not just the successes. And I'm especially moved by Lene's candor and her strength. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Lene Pettingill.
Hello, CCL family. It is so good to be with you again. And we have a lot to celebrate since we last had one of these conference chats, you and me. Since our November conference, you helped make history by creating the conditions which allowed for the first bipartisan climate legislation in over a decade, the Energy Innovation Act. Woohoo! This was the vision we had held for so long. And now we've made the first step a reality. A vision that many said was impossible, would never happen. But, as Mark Reynolds likes to say, my people eat impossible for breakfast. Which makes me think of two other characters talking about impossible and breakfast, Alice in Wonderland and the Queen of Hearts. I must say, it's a good thing that this room is not filled with Alice's. There's no use trying. One can't believe impossible things. No, this room is filled with wise, courageous visionaries who act more like the Queen of Hearts. I dare say you haven't had much practice. When I was younger, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to actually close your eyes. And together we're going to visualize some things which the Alices of this world might say are impossible, but you and I know one day we will make reality. And for anyone in the room super uncomfortable closing your eyes, you don't have to. But it will be much more powerful for those eyes closing folks, just saying. Okay, ready? So go ahead. Close your eyes, take a deep breath in, and as you let it out, open your mind to possibilities. First picture in your mind, November 27th, 2018, the day that the Energy Innovation Act was first introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives. An incredibly joyous day for us all. And then see in your mind, one day later, the press conference we held on the steps of the Capitol. You might have seen some of our CCL pictures or videos showing Congressman Deutsch at the microphone, surrounded by some very, very happy CCL volunteers. Volunteers with huge smiles on their faces, even as they brave the bitter wind and cold, holding up signs in celebration. An historic day, which you played a critical role in creating. Yes, you helped make history. Now continue to keep your eyes closed and let yourself be pulled forward in time. Feel momentum building in the U.S. for a significant climate solution. In fact, now we're back on those Capitol steps. This time, our press conference is to celebrate the actual passage of our climate bill. The House, the Senate, the President have all come on board. Somehow, every single one of us in this room has made it to the press conference. We're a huge, joyous crowd, reveling in this moment we've all worked so hard for. This moment that so many said was impossible, yet we held out our courageous vision of possibility and turned this vision into reality. Continuing to keep your eyes closed, allow this positive momentum to carry you forward even more. Several more years have gone by, and now many climate bills have passed. And huge breakthroughs have been made in carbon sequestration and other technological advances, which add even more momentum to all the enacted climate legislation. So much so that the carbon count has actually stopped rising. In fact, it's now starting to decrease, heading down, working its way back towards 350 parts per million. And with these reductions in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, our climate stabilizes. Our weather calms down, and the world lets out a collective sigh of relief, knowing we were finally able to turn this ship around, steering it back to safer, calmer waters. In a moment, we'll energetically come back to this time in this room, but before we do, know that you and the more than 1,500 other people in this room and the 135,000 plus other CCL volunteers outside this room and the millions of other climate activists all around this world are all practicing the impossible every single day. And together, we will ensure a healthy climate for generations to come. Take one last deep breath in, remembering this vision in your mind. And as you let it out, open your eyes. Thank you for playing along with me, and thank you for believing in as many as 6 impossible things each day. And as your development director, I'd like to thank you for the seemingly impossible fundraising goals that you help us shatter on a regular basis. In my 20 years of fundraising, I have never seen a more generous and devoted group of donors and volunteers. You inspire me each and every day. And each time I think one of our fundraising goals is not going to be met, you come through, donating generously, eating impossible for breakfast. So our combined budget this year for CCL and sister nonprofit Citizens Climate Education is $5.4 million. So far, we've raised $1.8 million towards this goal. Almost all this money is used to train and empower our amazing volunteers, you, and to coordinate and support your incredible actions. We have three top expense categories. One is our staff. We have 59 contract and full-time staff now, almost all of whom are working to support and empower you and all of our other volunteers. Secondly, we have two offices, one in Coronado, California, and one here in DC. Anyone here been to our Coronado office? A few hands. You know we are not living high on the hog out there. No, siree. Now, the DC office is a tad bit fancy, but it has to be in order to be an appropriate meeting place for this DC culture, for allied organizations and members of the press. And then our last big ticket item are regional and national conferences, almost always operating at a significant loss, which is a conscious decision we've made to keep this affordable for all and even offering scholarships for those in need. I'm proud to let you know that we keep our fundraising expenses to right around 15% each year, which is much better than average and what's considered acceptable. I keep a close eye on our expenses and assure you that each dollar you choose to invest in our work will be used wisely and prudently. If you are able to support our work with a gift, in addition to your amazing volunteer work, that'd be greatly appreciated. To do so, just go to our website, citizensclimatelobby.org, click on the donate button. And if you become an Evergreen monthly donor, your gift will be matched each month by our Climate Guardian matching gift pool. So Climate Guardian donors make contributions of $10,000 or more in support of our work, and they play a critical role in our ability to make budget each year. If you happen to be able to support our work at this level or know someone who would and would like to learn more, please see me or one of the members of my awesome development team right up front here at the break. Or you can contact me later. My contact info is in the annual report that you received in your conference materials, and my contact info is on the last page. I'll be thrilled to hear from you. So, as the Queen of Hearts suggests, let's keep practicing the impossible every single day. And let's joyously celebrate each and every time we create a new, hopeful, exciting reality. I know we will. Thank you so much.